Well, history teaches that when harvest is good, civilization expands. But when the harvest is poor, civilizations contract. History's lesson leads us to ask, what does the harvest portend for our civilization?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 704th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Ollantaytambo, Peru, who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, it's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. True enough, civilizations do rise and fall with the availability of food, as aptly illustrated in Empires of Food by Evan Fraser and Andrew Remus, who go on to do me one better by claiming that we are all slaves to food. If our claims are indeed true, they do raise some very interesting questions. Like, why did the harvest allow for the rapid expansion of history's great civilizations? What happened to the harvest that caused those great civilizations to contract and disappear? And last but certainly not least, what does the harvest portend for our civilization? Well, on the phone today to help us figure this out, we have Evan, we have Andrew. Is with us today, Andrew Remus, who's the co-author of Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. So all I have to do is figure out how to get him on the air.
Hello.
Gotcha. Good. Yes. Okay.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm having some interesting times with my phone system here today, but that happens occasionally. On live radio, who knows what happens?
well, it makes it more exciting.
You're a print journalist, so that doesn't happen to you, right?
No, that's something I can luckily avoid. So, I don't have that high impact stress of live broadcasting.
Well,
live writing would be pretty bad, I imagine.
Yeah, so it's always interesting. But we have you here, and glad to have you aboard.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
So this is Empires of Food is not your first food effort. You did Beef: The Untold Story as well, co-authored, right?
That's correct. Our first book, well, Evan and I are a writing team, and our first book was Beef, The Untold Story of How Milk, Meat, and Muscle Shaped the World.
And that they most certainly did. And Empires of Food, you could have called it Travels with Carletti.
That's right, yes. We wrote a broad history of really the world's agriculture, but we framed it through the voyage of a Renaissance merchant, through 16th century Italian merchant who was one of the first commercial travelers to circumnavigate the globe. And he did so taking a very long time and trading food along the way and sampling a lot of local food, and he kept a fascinating diary. So when he got back, he wrote it all up. And we refer to it as one of the history's most inept business trips because he set out as a young man from Italy. It took him 14-odd years to make his way around the globe, during which the course of which he made and lost a fortune. So he ended up really no richer than when he started out.
But he left the world with an incredible story, which, of course, is what you built Empires of Food around, the adventures of his seeing the world back then and the empires of food that were developing. How did you become a foodie?
Well, I've been a journalist for my entire professional life, and I've always had an interest in history. So for me, the focus of food and what initially attracted me to writing about food was its social impact and its historical impact. I actually conceived of the idea for our book on the social history of cattle when I was sitting on an airplane from Frankfurt back to Boston, and the airline stewardess came along pushing her trolley, asking the passengers if they wanted beef or pasta, and I got my little my little container with a square of meat in it, and it got me wondering, how on earth did we come to this?
Eating beef at 35,000 feet above the Pacific or the Atlantic Ocean, right?
Right, exactly. You know, how did an animal come to occupy this position in our society, yeah, where it is such a given part of our diet? And it got me thinking about the broader impacts of that particular animal on our religion, on our social structures, on the development of art and social divisions, on aristocracy and money. And so I wrote up a book proposal, and I sent it off to my old friend Evan, who was a professor at the University of Leeds at the time. And he liked the idea so much, he asked if he could help write it. And so he introduced the sustainability angle. Mm-hmm. Evan is a professor primarily of sustainable agriculture, and he's done a lot of studies on the impact of agriculture on the environment. And so he brought that element to it.
So I'd like to introduce a notion about stones that I picked up in my travels. I guess I'm a mini Carletti and up business travels, you know, traveling around the world. One of my trips was at the behest of an environmental organization who asked me to help redevelop an agricultural plateau on the island of Cyprus. Mm. And so I was spending time over there above Paphos up on the hills. And while there, the organization that brought me over there was also hosting a convocation of Egyptologists at Giza Village, at the Mina House right there beneath the Great Pyramid of Cheops. So I was flying in and out of Cairo, and in doing so, flying in from the north, you know, one of the things that really strikes you, of course, is that you come in over the Nile Delta, and anybody who's the least bit interested in food and the history of food, of course, is cognizant of the history of the Nile Delta. And so I found myself sitting there right underneath the Great Pyramid of Cheops at lunch with a whole bunch of Egyptologists. And, of course, their conversation was focused on the whys and wherefores and whatnots of the pyramids. And I just happened to pipe up without really thinking about it much. I know why the pyramids were put there. And, of course, they all looked at me like, what are you, some kind of fool? You wrote a book about farming. What does that have to do with the pyramids? Well, I just said, you know, imagine yourself a pharaoh with a population of well-fed, energetic people. And, of course, that's what the Nile Delta was all about. You could just throw seeds at it, and in a few days you'd have food. And so here's a pharaoh with a population of well-fed, energetic people. What do you do with them? You have to put them to work doing something. So the Giza Plateau is the first solid ground above the Nile Delta. So I just said, you know, there it is. He's got a population that you have to do something with. So he tells them, go over there and get those rocks and pile them up over here. And thus the pyramids. Then cut away to the Urubamba River Valley of Peru, which is also a very fecund place in history, the breadbasket of the Inca Empire. And at the bottom of the valley, you have, of course, Machu Picchu. And people always wonder, what on earth were they thinking when they built Machu Picchu? And I raise my hand, of course, and say, I know what they were doing, you know. You have a population of well-fed, energetic Incas, and you tell them to go get the rocks over there and build a guard post right there at the entrance to the Urubamba River Valley, so that way we can keep all of our enemies out. But in the process, we'll build this wonderful edifice because we have the time and we have the energy. And is that really what you're talking about with respect to food and civilization, that how it works?
Well, that's an absolutely fascinating point of having wealth and surplus, which then creates the need to use up labor. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the case of Egypt, you also have the factor that for several months during the year, when the rivers flood, when the Nile floods the Delta,
right.
You can't actually do any farming.
Right.
So you just have to wait for it to settle down, and so they had time on their hands as well.
Idle hands are the devil's playground, right?
Precisely so.
So go get those rocks over there and bring them over here.
Right. I mean, yeah, if you wanted to secure your authoritarian central government, then it's probably not a good idea to have a lot of, as you say, well-fed, idle hands. But what our concept of a food empire is certainly based on the idea of surplus. When you have a civilization that expands through agriculture, which historically civilizations always have, they push their network of farms and roads and trading systems and markets outwards as far as they can.
Okay, let's hold on to that and pick it up when we come back from this quick break. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. Today we're talking about the expansion of empires and civilizations with the harvest. What impact does the harvest have on our future? We're talking with Andrew Remus, co-author of Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilization, and you right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, it always starts with a surplus, right? Need excess food, and then you can get a civilization going. And once a civilization gets going, where does it go from there? Let's ask Andrew Remus, who is the co-author of Empires of Food, Feast and Famine, The Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Let's go back and look at the Nile Delta and its great supply of wheat and how Rome used that wheat. Andrew?
Sure. Now, Rome was an interesting case of a food empire that was successful for a very long time due to a number of factors. But as the city expanded and as the empire expanded during the Republican period, in the late centuries B.C., the hinterland around Rome became steadily more barren, and the farmlands in the Italian peninsula became steadily less productive due to over-farming, soil erosion, and pretty bad land management practices.
Mm-hmm. We just used it up, right?
Precisely. And as the population, of course, of the city expanded, this proved to be pretty frightening for a lot of the political leaders. So one of the consequences of the expansion of Rome's military empire and geographic empire was that you ended up having a lot more lands that you could farm in, put under production, and then bring the food from the outskirts to the center. So they developed a very complicated system of warehouses and transportation networks.
And roads?
Roads, of course, being very one of the big parts of it, and Roman engineering was put to its highest use in really delivering armies out and pulling food back in. So when they conquered Egypt and at the end of the civil wars, at the beginning and at the end of the Republican period, they put the very rich Egyptian lands to use as a breadbasket for the city of Rome itself, and they instituted they had a grain fleet that went out, did two big deliveries a year, went out across the Mediterranean and brought back enough grain to the port of Ostia, 15 miles or 22 miles away from Rome, to feed the city. And, of course, they instituted, this was a way of keeping the urban population fed and politically docile. Of course, to do that sort of massive transference of food, you needed to have a very complicated system of storage warehouses. And they developed standard blueprints for building warehouses in the empire. They fought wars in order to rid the sea lanes of pirates. And they passed political laws allowing military generals to have very sweeping executive powers in order to secure these grain routes. The crux of it, though, was it was always still very fragile because you still could have a crack in the system that would cause food riots in Rome and that would cause hunger and starvation. And over the course of the imperial period, you did end up seeing a drop in the food supply that really hit around 300 BC. And this wasn't so much due to a failure on Rome's organizational parts, but it was due to a failure to really perceive how climate affects food supplies. There was a cooling off around the year 300 BC, and productivity in the Mediterranean dropped. And when that happened, the entire structure, that the edifice, which needed to be paid for by taxation, started to collapse because when you had less food, there were fewer taxes collected, fewer than soldiers that you could pay for, and therefore there was less security, less infrastructure, and gradually then that turned into a cycle where there was less food being delivered.
And it's always easy to forget about the impact of climate and the natural cycles of the climate. When things go right for a few years, you always expect them to go right, right?
Well, that's correct. I mean, most of the food empires of history have been built on a number of assumptions. And one of those assumptions is that we're always going to have gentle sunny weather with periods of rainfall, and that we can rely on that mm-hmm. long term.
We don't have to save them, too, because it's always going to be perfect.
Right, precisely. Yeah. Another of our assumptions is that the soil will always be fertile and that it won't erode underneath our feet, or underneath, rather, our plows, which is a pretty big assumption to make.
It lasts generally for a few years. And then
indeed it does. And but people throughout history tended to have always assumed that once a piece of land is productive, it will always be productive.
Right.
And we've, of course, have overcome that with manufactured fertilizers, with chemical fertilizers. But those are, of course, based on the use of a large amount of fossil fuel. We can't create those fertilizers without using a tremendous amount of fossil fuels.
And also, technically, those fertilizers do not really increase the fertility of soil, per se.
No, it just masks it.
Yes.
Of course. So it's really a false fix. Particularly, we're just, instead of being trapped to the availability of natural fertilizers, we're now trapped to the availability.
Right.
We're tied to the availability of fossil fuels. One of the examples that we used in our book, which I think is the most illustrative of a simple dynamic for a food empire to rise and fall, is that of medieval Europe, and that was a very straightforward arc. That we saw with their food productivity and
we're talking climate productivity. We're talking the Dark Ages, right?
Precisely.
We think of as the Dark Ages.
Yes, precisely. Starting in what we think of as the Dark Ages, after the fall of the Roman Empire, much of Europe.
Well, before we go there, and I certainly do want to go there because I found that to be one of the most fascinating accounts in your tale. What happened to the Roman Empire with respect to its food?
Well, with respect to the Roman Empire. When the climate got cooler, the farms became less productive. There became more and more problems of delivering large amounts of food to urban centers. And we start to see the size of the warehouses shrink, and also the size of apartment buildings even shrink. Population started to climb gradually. There was no sudden collapse in mass. There were certainly famines in Rome, but not ones that completely decimated the population until much later. But starting around the year 300, we just see a pulling back, an exhaustion, a lowering of population levels, lowering taxes. The emperors imposed they stopped collecting money for taxes, and they demanded that taxes be paid in grain because
wow.
there wasn't enough to go around. And so once there wasn't enough grain to really go around, we just see withdrawal of civilization. People who farmed fell into disuse. Cities shrank back into
so it really wasn't then the invasion of the hordes from the north. It was really the loss of that ability to grow enough food that
I wouldn't say that. I would say that was certainly a factor. There were many, many factors that contributed to the collapse mm-hmm. of the Western Empire, but a loss of food was certainly one of the one of the aspects of the decline. And it may have been also a symptom as well as a cause, but it was certainly an integral part to why urban civilization in Western Europe pretty much fell apart and, or to a large part, just became exhausted and withdrew. And in the East as well, in the Byzantines Empire, much the same thing happened, but it took much longer for it to fall apart. Egypt remained productive for a long time, but the Eastern Empire...
Because of the continual flooding of the Nile Delta.
Right, because of the unique geographical situation there, the unique agricultural situation. But the rest of the empire...
And quickly, we have to go to a break here in a moment, but... And what happened to the Golden Triangle?
Well, the Golden Triangle... I'm sorry?
Mesopotamia.
Oh, Mesopotamia, yes. Well, that became exhausted much earlier due to their system where they were essentially salting their own fields. Their canals that they had dug to irrigate their grain fields, they baked in the heat, and they had a very high level of salinity. So every time that they irrigated their fields,
they
were effectively salting it, yes.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to go into the Dark Ages and figure out how we fed ourselves in the Dark Ages when there was not much to hold us together. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson with Andrew Remus and you right back. History teaches that when the harvest is good, civilizations expand. But when the harvest is poor, civilizations contract. Well, what happened when the Roman Empire contracted is that we went into the Dark Ages. But why do they call them the Dark Ages? Let's ask Andrew Remus, co-author of Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Andrew, what happened to civilization when Rome fell?
Well, the term the Dark Ages isn't terribly fashionable anymore, but it's an accurate way of describing how the light of urban civilization certainly dimmed, and you had a pretty massive population drop-off after the fall of the Roman Empire, as well as a withdrawal of urban culture.
What you're saying is that the cities kind of disappeared.
They did. They melted away. Farms melted back into scrub land and forest, and populations melted away out of the cities. So we had a massive downturn in more or less every measurable form of urban civilization. Lots of people died, or lots of people just didn't reproduce. And how the medieval civilization really arose back out of that was due to the agriculture spread by monks, due to monasteries. And monks and monasteries, yes. Monasteries were the vehicle that allowed the medieval recovery. So as the Dark Ages hit Europe and things fell apart, that was about that time that was when the forerunners of the medieval monasteries started to appear in southern France. And you had an idea spread in these monasteries of finding salvation and paying homage to God through labor, through hard work. It was a way of keeping the people who took the vows busy. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that they worked, of course, was through farming. So the monks went out into the benighted areas to spread the word of God, and they very often brought with them tools. They would chop down trees, and they would plant fields in order to feed first the monastery, but then they would also feed the people who were attracted to the monastery, and people would come to work there. People would gather around the chapter houses and create industries, and the monks were great technical innovators. They developed new forms of plows. They tinkered with windmills. They also really invented the brewing industry as we know it today, which was a way of converting the surplus into something that could be traded for further wealth.
Because let's explain that really quickly. Because when you have grain, the grain rots before you can get it very far. But if you turn it into beer and put it into kegs, you can take it a ways and sell it.
Precisely. Alcohol is inherently preserved. It's a way of transforming something that will rot and a surplus that cannot be turned into wealth into something that you can sell or trade.
So these monks in these monasteries kind of provided the start of food chains wherever they went then.
Precisely. They went everywhere. As the centuries went on and European civilization recovered, they pushed further out into the peripheries, bringing their industry and their message to further and further tribes and further corners of Europe.
One of the things that you wrote that really struck me about the efficacy of these monasteries was that they didn't just go away when people passed on or moved on. They stayed there. So there was a local knowledge that was developed and passed from one monk to the next. So they knew how to do things, and they had this knowledge that built up over time, and that they kept that knowledge that built up over time. Whereas education really is just one generation deep when it gets right down to it. So if there's nobody to transmit that knowledge from one generation to the next, it disappears. But that's what made the monastery unique, right?
Well, monasteries certainly were all about education, and you did have a literate, educated class that developed out of that, but also a very professional one, because they did pass along techniques of beekeeping and farming and technology to further and further generations. There were instruction manuals. They studied these processes and improved them. And furthermore, because they didn't pass their wealth down to the children and spread it out amongst generations, the wealth remained concentrated where it was.
So the monasteries got to be pretty well-to-do places then, right?
Extremely wealthy, and that meant the growth of urban civilization. Because when you have wealth and money, you therefore have people who can have time to do things like copy out manuscripts or invent hymns or
build pyramids or
cathedrals, for that matter.
There we go again, huh? So where was civil authority in the Dark Ages?
Well, civil authority, obviously, we don't deal with that as much because we were more interested in the economic history of the Dark Ages. But obviously there was a lot of conflict, certainly in the 11th century, between the church and the state, which the state eventually did win. But regarding the story about food, the monks were the innovators. The monks drove the creation of wealth and the creation of transportation networks during that period, but they also ended up being the root of its collapse, because as the monks expanded their fields and as they created these urban centers, the population grew. As the population grows, you continue to need to grow more and more food. So they spread their farms further and further into the peripheries. Once the easy lands had been put under cultivation, people started to climb up into the hills, taking their axes and their plows, and they would deforest the hills, plant crops, and continue to grow the population. This worked very well for a long time until, of course, soil erosion started to kick in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started to see some pretty big downturns in the population and eventually the crisis of the 13th and 14th centuries.
So we seem to be picking up a pattern here.
There is an arc, more of an arc than a circle, for food empires, which is expansion followed by a pretty strong contraction due to environmental factors. And medieval Europe was a prime example of that. It was a very clear-cut case of you grew and grew and grew and grew until you couldn't grow anymore due to soil erosion, due to climate change, and due to basically due to soil erosion and climate change. And then the efficacy of the farms went backwards. The population can't be sustained anymore, and you start to have some pretty massive problems. So that is the cycle we've seen over and over.
And do we see any exceptions to that rule?
Well, I mean, there are an awful lot of civilizations that you know, sputter out in various ways. But history pretty much teaches us from the perspective of our book, anyway, that nothing lasts forever. And when we look at our own society, we do see some of the same mistakes that people have made in the past.
Sound like any fun at all.
Well, I mean, of course, there are ways we can change the way we produce our food, and there are ways we can change how we maintain our agricultural system. But we are making a number of the same mistakes.
Well, we're going to pick those back up when we come back from this break, but I'd like to take a look at China, because you do take a look at China. And China, of course, has now become the 500-pound monkey in the room for just about everything. So we'll look at our food chain with respect to China and the promise of the Green Revolution. And can we escape what has happened to all other civilizations with respect to our harvest? This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. Today we are talking about the impact of food on civilization with Andrew Remus, co-author of Empires of Food, Feast and Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilization. And you, we can pick up some phone calls. Our number today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned. Right back with the Food Chain. Well, there's a pattern to it all, to the rise and fall of civilizations. We start with an abundance of food, more than enough. And when we have more than enough food, we develop specialization of labor. We learn how to do different things. Some of us are farmers. Some of us are soldiers. Some of us become musicians and writers and artists and chefs and everything else. But it all depends on that surplus of food. And with that surplus of food, the civilization grows and expands and develops more agriculture and more. And so the two grow in tandem. Agriculture produces and the civilization consumes. And then something happens to agriculture, and all of a sudden the bountiful harvest is not quite so bountiful anymore. Perhaps it's the weather or insect pests or something happens. The soil plays out. All kinds of things can happen and do happen and have happened throughout history. And great civilizations have thus come and gone. And we do have a great civilization now to talk about. It's the civilization of the New World Order, a civilization in which an empty net in Vietnam may cause riots in the Caribbean. Holy smokes, how does this happen, Andrew?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, China is the 500-pound gorilla in the agricultural, I guess, in the barn. It is the agricultural powerhouse of the world, and much as it's the manufacturing one now as well. But in the 21st century, we have seen in the past 20 years, we've seen Chinese agriculture just grow beyond all proportions of anything that's happened before.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's doing this due to very large programs of fertilization and of water transfer and of land management. But it's also becoming very wealthy as a result of its economic expansion, and so China is now able to buy food from other places as well. And that is one of the interesting things that we're going to be seeing as we go ahead. Because China right now does produce enough to feed itself. Despite its colossal population, it is still growing enough rice and growing enough grain to feed its people, who are getting used to a Western-style, very rich diet. Meat consumption, for instance, has really gone skyrocketed in the past 15 years there. And they're starting to have problems with obesity and diseases like diabetes that were once far more common in the West are now on the rise in China due to diet. But the real factor here is China, if it suffers a drought, if it suffers a failure of its harvests, it will be able to go to the world commodities markets and buy what it needs.
Because it has the money.
Because it has the money. And that's exactly what happened this past summer when grain prices skyrocketed. There were China was buying up an awful lot of grain from Canada and other sources, driving prices of grain up. And I think we're going to see this happening a lot more in the future. When there isn't enough to go around in China, it will buy it on the market. And that means that places, for instance, that can't afford it, like sub-Saharan Africa and various developing nations will have to go without. And we've seen historical precedents for this over and over again as well. It happened in the 19th century in the British Empire, which most people don't think of the British Empire as a period of famine. But, of course, there are two very famous famines in the 19th century in the British Empire. The Irish one, which was a failure of a local food system. A potato crop, exactly. And then there was also a famine in southern Asia, particularly in Sri Lanka, where you had really hundreds of thousands of people in Asia starved to death due to a system of global trading, really. The British had created tea plantations in Sri Lanka where people worked for a wage, and then the tea was sold to British consumers, and the money then was used to buy grain from other sources.
And all of the local agriculture then was plowed under?
All of the local agriculture disappeared. And that worked okay as long as there was still tea to sell and grain to buy. But when a bad series of El Nino years ruined the crops, ruined the tea crops, the grain that was still grown in India was sold to richer markets, was sold abroad, so that the people in the actual villages near where the grain was being grown couldn't afford it. So, I mean, globalization has been with us for a long time, and we are all interconnected. But I think the main factor that we talk about in the 21st century will be the emergence of China is the emergence of China as a player in agriculture as well as manufacturing and other economic factors. My co-author, Evan, went to China to mm-hmm. look at the Three Gorges Dam and to look at the North-South Water Transference Project. And, we write about it a fair amount in the book, but just the scale of it.
So we have a billion people. They're hungry. And they have the money. And what is that going to mean for the rest of us? Do stay tuned. We'll be right back with Evan, with Andrew, and we'll talk about what he sees for the future of our harvest and what it portends for the future of our civilization. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Andrew, Remus, and you. We will be right back. Well, folks, China makes the things that we buy, and they have our money as a consequence. There's a billion of them. They're very hungry. So what's going to happen when somehow the abundant harvest that we've had for so long goes short? What do you think? And Andrew, Remus, what do you think? Remus, what do you think is going to happen with our food when we come to that inevitable crunch? Let's see. Press the button here.
We are facing climate change, and we are facing a world where our water supply is less and less reliable as well. What will probably happen will be increasing economic and political instability, but the real problem, I think, that we have to, the question we have to ask is, how are we going to feed the world as we head to a world population of 9 billion people forecasted by the year 2050? And as it stands, our current system doesn't offer a reliable answer. It's really more of a system of band-aids, of chemical fixes, of trading a reliance on water for a reliance on fossil fuels. And as resources become more and more strapped, and as climate change really becomes more and more of a factor in our agriculture, I think we're going to see a realignment and a readjustment of food prices primarily. I think food's going to become a lot more expensive going forward. And I think the people who are able to buy it, people in the privileged parts of the world, like ourselves, are going to see that there's probably going to be a lot more social unrest on the peripheries, and our own food may very well go down in quality.
So what you're saying is that the pattern you have seen throughout history is likely to repeat itself again.
I would say so, unless we make some fixes, and unless we start to think about food in a different way than we do right now. Instead of thinking about it in the way of producing as much of a surplus and a profit, we need to think about ways to continue to nurture it looking forward into the future and think of husbanding our resources to a degree.
Have people ever thought about that? I mean, have you ever seen a civilization that actually, you know, thought about slow food or something?
Well, you know, I don't think it's really much in our nature to think, you know, too far ahead. But now there's no reason for us not to, because we do have the tools to forecast, and we do have
the ability to look back in history and consider.
Exactly.
Let's go quickly to Roy, who has a comment about China. Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, just a quick comparison. The last numbers that I saw on strawberry production out of China was 1.5 billion pounds produced by 1 million farmers versus the U.S. was 1 billion pounds produced by
13 farmers.
Just about, maybe 1,000, less than 1,000. Let's put it that way. So, yes, China does have massive production capability, but it's still very... very
labor intensive, but
well,
they
it's
have
labor intensive. It's very, you know, by our standards, it's low tech, and there's nothing wrong with low tech, but it's low tech. The other thing is, I think any shortages in the future will be induced by man vis-a-vis environmental regulations. We saw this recently with the Delta smelt.
Yeah, same thing.
Restriction on water transfers. I mean, we've got the technology. We'll never have another potato famine like Ireland had, because we've got the effective
fungicide.
Rory,
you said the frightening word, never. Thank you very much for the call. We got to go.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Andrew Remus, do you think there'll be a never?
No, I don't think you can confidently say that. I think Rory was a bit of a...
he's a very much of an optimist.
I think he believes that we can engineer our way out of problems, and so far we have.
Okay, Andrew, out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Folks, the book is Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilization, a worthwhile read. Thanks, you, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.